When the art day gets rough, you just gotta keep on punching. And here's your Thunder Punch Daily with Jersey Drozd.
Here's another prompt submitted via the form at baronvonbera.com/AMA, where a listener asks, having a collection of cursed items in your book is rife for pop culture references. What's the cultural reference you're most excited about but are afraid people won't get? I spent a few minutes thinking about this question before I hit record, and the thought occurred to me, and there's no way this is what the listener intended, but it's making me realize how much I take myself seriously as an artist, and I take my art very seriously, but only up to a point. And one of those points that I stop taking myself seriously is, are there any hard and fast rules of good art always has this or never has that? And what do I mean is that the prompt itself reminded me of the whole notion of Easter eggs. And I would say, is there any other word for it besides Easter eggs? Like, embedded or encoded gags meant for a specific audience. The example that I think of most readily is there's a joke in the Transformers Beast Wars cartoon, which was from 1996, so like a good, 12 years or 10 years, 9 years after the original series concluded, where the Maximals literally turn to the camera and make a joke about how the older Transformers use die-cast construction, and that's a lost art, meaning that, or referring to the fact that the original toys actually had die-cast metal parts, which they don't do anymore, and they weren't doing in 1996. And I remember, as a viewer, chuckling that, oh, that was a joke meant for me. It wasn't meant for the 10-year-olds watching the show. They're not necessarily going to know what that means. But when they get older, maybe they'll find out. Anyway, it doesn't matter. But I also, at that time, was friendly with a group of cartoonists in the Michigan, perimeter. What would you call it? All over Michigan, because I would go to conventions in, like, Novi and Detroit, et cetera, Dearborn. And they would say things every once in a while like, there's no such thing as a good story that has a ninja in it. I'm like, well, that seems kind of severe. It seems like you're really closing the door on something that could provide a really novel approach to something. Anyway, so when I think about Easter eggs, I think about people I've heard say, like, it's like you don't want to have, like, it's annoying when there's too many Easter eggs, or that becomes the point, or waiting for the extra scene at the end of the movie credits and so on. And sure enough, I've also been the person who gets a little harumphy when I show up to a piece of media and I have to read like a 5-page instruction manual before I enter the media, right? So I could go either way, but the main thing is that I want to just like reflect on the fact that I'm surprised to hear myself say that, like, no, I don't like it when people close the door on an idea. So Easter eggs, are they in Baron Von Bear? Kind of. But as I reflect on this, I'm surprised to think about the fact that I didn't really bury a lot of private jokes or pop culture references in Baron Von Bear's collection. As a matter of fact, I went and pulled out the pages where the collection appears very clearly. And no, I did not. I mean, there's one reference to a friend's comic in there. As I look through, I'm seeing things like, oh, there's a little mini arcade game, kind of like the old, back in like the early 80s, they made like these little tabletop versions of like popular arcade games like Pac-Man and Galaga and so on. But it was like, like 8 inches tall, and it was by no means a perfect replication of the original game. It was a very, very cheap version of the game, but just like it mimicked the cabinet. So I put one of those in there thinking like, okay, well, there could be such a thing as a cursed video game in this universe. This is a fantasy world, but it also has technology. And plus it's drawn so tiny, it's like I can use it in the future or maybe not use it in the future. I don't care. But the main thing was for me is that in designing the collection of objects, I was really, my first concern was don't hem myself in too much. So keep the collection that we see fairly vague so that I have some latitude to interpret some of those objects down the road if you know, fortune's willing, I get to do more of these Baron von Baer books. What I did do in developing the collection, now this is where we get to like a little bit of a researchy kind of bit about the making of this book, is when I landed upon the idea of how the cursed object collection worked, because there was like, you know, I've shared in some of these microcasts, it was 20 years of me thinking about this character before the story idea really locked itself in. And in early iterations of Baron von Baer, he himself was a cursed object who was held captive with all the cursed objects by this wicked person. They get rid of the wicked person, and now Baron von Baer is just like sort of the caretaker of the place. But he himself wants to lift the curse and become a regular teddy bear someday, kind of thing. That was an early iteration of the story. But when I landed on the idea of, nope, it's going to be cursed objects at the beginning of the story, but we find out there's something else. The cursed objects are actually some other kind of thing at the end of the story. And this is in the pitch line. I'm not spoiling anything. It's like he will learn to his dismay that the objects are not at all what he expected, right? So when I landed on that, I was like, okay, the next step is, how do I create a collection of cursed objects that feels somewhat authentic? Even if it's fantastical, I want it to be grounded a little bit in reality. I could go on a whole side thing here about like originality and what originality is, right? It's like, what I didn't want to do was just make up objects that my imagination, my uninformed, uneducated imagination could come up with. Now, I'm educated in the sense that I have a lot of experience reading fantasy and reading mythology and writing my own stuff. I've read a lot of books, but I'm not an archaeologist, and I'm not a museum registrar. And while I'm married to somebody who works in museums, I don't personally have the experience of cataloging ancient objects, but I know people who do. So I reached out to friends of mine who actually work in ancient object preservation. I was very fortunate in that I know people who actually do this for a living. One of whom has a degree in Egyptology, right? So I just had a phone conversation with them and said, you know, what are, like, when I say, you know, cursed object, what objects that you've cataloged in the past would you think of as like, oh, that would be a good thing to have a ghost in it? And we talked for like an hour on this about like different kinds of things. So that's where most of the collection came from. As I remember, she said, and I wish I had the list in front of me. I have it someplace, but it's not right in front of me right now. But we came up with this list where one of them was a skull with a hinged lid, like was something that she's actually cataloged before. And I was like, oh, okay, that's where the head of Lobo comes from. There is an actual werewolf head in the story that contains the spirit of a werewolf. So if you open up the top of the head and let the spirit out, it'll make werewolves happen all around you. So kind of like half zombie, half vampire, and like, but it looks like a werewolf kind of idea. And I know that doesn't fit the tradition of werewolves, but that's not what I was after here. I wasn't out to accurately reflect and ground the monsters based on monster lore. I was just trying to use ancient objects in museums as a springboard to come up with imaginative fiction. Okay, so hinged skull with a hinged lid. What would you do with that? Okay, well, I'll make it a werewolf head. Another one was a severed, like a skeletal severed hand that claws and grips and steals. That was something that, and obviously the hand in question did not do that in this museum, but I mean, there was mummified and preserved human remains in some of these places, right? And so I was like, okay, well, that's where, you know, maybe it could be like a cursed claw, and there's something kind of gruesome about a cursed body part that moves about the world, right? So it can get into an implied horror kind of idea. And I forget some of the other, what were some of the other ones? I would have to pull up the list. But the main thing was is that instead of going to like, okay, well, I'm going to refer to Indiana Jones movies directly, or I'm going to refer to Friday the 13th, the series, the television series, which is part of the inspiration for the whole idea of Baron Von Baer, because that was a television show about three people who are trying to decurse a collection of hellish objects in this store. I decided to instead just go to, you know, other sources and look. And as here's another place where I went for inspiration is I, you know, Instagram is a great tool for sharing photos, but I followed a bunch of archaeology accounts and they post all the time, all these different things in their collections, these ancient objects. I'm like, that would be a cool curse thing. That would be a cool curse thing. You know, here's like a, you know, here's a cat mummy. Here's a canopic jar, right? All these different kinds of things that, okay, that looks like something that would, you could put an interesting spin on what would happen if you opened this thing up, or what would happen if you put it in the improper context. So, yeah, as I'm looking at this thing, I see like a necklace, a talisman. I see a number of stone carvings. I see what looks like a wooden mask. Oh, there's an Atari joystick in there. Okay, there's one pop culture reference. But again, it was mostly me going to this idea of like, can I do a broad sort of sweep between things that we instantly recognize as an ancient object and things that could just be like, oh, this is maybe from 100 years ago. Because another thing that, you know, standard comics make a lot of hay out of is the fact that, like, in all these haunted house stories, it's always somebody from the 1800s. It's never, like, a caveman ghost or a dinosaur ghost, right? So I wanted to do something that, like, felt, like, a little bit more, like, remote, but not quite as remote as, say, ancient Sumer, right? See what looks like a Roman helmet, another kind of, like, statue, a captain's hat. And there's a canopic jar, you know. It was, again, it was less about, for me, it was less about making anything that people could, like, play Where's Waldo with, and more of, can I give an impression of an ancient, dusty place that has a lot of stories in it? Not that I'm asking you to leap off and make up stories about this stuff. I don't want to focus on it that much, because the collection itself is more of a MacGuffin in the story, in that it's a thing that has to be dispersed for Baron Von Baer to go track it down, and we only focus on three or four different pieces in the collection. Because it's only 217 pages, for crying out loud. But knowing that I would like to do more down the road, I purposefully kept it a relatively vague collection. Now, at the end, there is an object that shows up, and it's actually three stones that are carved in the shape of hippos. And I might have been going for, like, a obliquely referring to the Shankara stones from Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, maybe. I couldn't tell you that for sure, but because, like, they're not just, like, three stones with markings on them. They're actually carved to have, like, hippo faces on them. So maybe, but are there references that I'm worried people won't get? You know, not really. There are lines of dialogue and character moments where I can tell you, oh, this was born right out of this moment from this cartoon that I love. This is me sort of like blowing it, that cartoon a kiss, but that's between me and the cartoon. And it's by no means as clear and unambiguous as, say, C-3PO and R2-D2 walking across the desert in A New Hope, and then you watch the opening scene of the Hidden Fortress, and it's like, oh, wow, he was like doing an homage to that very scene, right? It's nothing like that direct. Most of what I've nested in this is, like I said, purposefully kept open-ended so that I have room to play with it later on. Now, when I'm designing some of these things, what are the constraints that I'm thinking about? Like when I'm drawing some of the spirits in the background of Baron Von Baer's house or some of the objects themselves, mostly what I'm thinking about is just like, can The rubric is it cute and a little spooky? That's all I'm ever going for. I don't have stories like somebody saw one of my original pages recently and there was a pumpkin monster running in the scene and they said, who's that character? I'm like, well, I don't know. it's a cute, spooky pumpkin character just running in the background because I'm just trying to give this place like an element of atmosphere, an element of invitation to wondering about the world. And if I could go on a small tangent here about that, is that this is something I've had kind of a rocky relationship with, this whole idea of world building. Because when I was younger, I took very seriously the sometimes thrown around advice of like, write more about your story than what the reader will get, because then your world will feel grounded and lived in. And I think there's a truth to that, but I think there's what happened to me was I kind of went too far. And I started writing this, what was going to be a multi-volume graphic novel series, and I filled notebook after notebook after notebook about all this world building. I told this before. And I spent so much time doing that that I never really landed on what a narrative would be about this. I had like all of this like sociology and, you know, and you know, environment design, building design, all figured out, but I didn't know what the heck the story was even about. And then eventually just like, it just felt like a D&D supplement. It didn't feel like the beginning of a book. And when I think about the stories that I enjoy, because remember, I'm making this book with the knowledge that I'm writing to a very, relatively speaking, a niche audience, in that I'm writing to kids who are like me, who kids who didn't feel like they had a whole lot of support in their childhood, who want to get lost in a world where they can try on different characters to take their perspectives or try out their identity, and maybe get something that feels supportive and healthful without being overly didactic and preachy. And so when I think of the stories I like the ones that give me an intimation of world, an implication of this is how this universe works, without getting too lost in the weeds about defining and explaining or representing every corner of it. Again, I keep going back to that advice, or not advice, but like this perspective that a friend shared with me where he pointed out in the Back to the Future movie, they just go, this is the flux capacitor, this makes time travel possible. Boom, we're done. We don't have to explain it any further than that. Now, Baron von Baer digs a little bit more into it than that, because like, I did find myself facing some story problems in terms of like, well, the villains are teleporting to catch up to the MacGuffins, and the heroes aren't teleporting. So how is it that the heroes can catch up at all? Well, I have some of the characters explain the limitations of teleport magic. So there's a little bit of that. But when I think of, again, like most of the stuff that inspired what I'm into, or rather the kinds of stories that inspired the type of storytelling Baron von Baer does, it's that it does just enough grounding that you can kind of believe in it, but it doesn't bother itself with too much explaining and defining how the world works. There's an awful lot in the cartoons that I love of the characters, like in the 4 Million Years Later podcast, which I did with my buddy Hoover. We talk about that in like the first season of the Transformers. Optimus Prime will say, let's roll! And they transform into car mode and they drive to Australia. It's like, how does that even work? You know, but as a kid, I just took it for granted. Oh, somehow they got there. I don't know. You know, in a later Transformers series, they actually did explain like the global space bridge, which was like this series of like hyper tunnels all throughout the Earth that they could drive upon. And I'm like, that's cool and everything, but I didn't need that explanation. So I show up as a little bit more of a forgiving audience in that regard. I'm not saying, well, but how come this and not that? At least not on that kind of stuff, not on world building. So once again, rounding back to my initial point is that I hope this doesn't disappoint too much, and I hope I've gone down enough peripheral tracks to like contextualize it in an interesting way. But yeah, I don't have a whole lot of things that refer to anything else. I was, when it came to my monster designs and spirit designs, I was trying to just play with whimsy and just say a bunch of imaginative what-if stuff without really worrying about what I was going to do with it later, but leave it open-ended so I could do something with it later. Like, I'm actually looking at a page right now where there's a dinosaur, like the Velociraptor skeleton ghost in one of the rooms. And that was just literally born out of the old joke of how come we never see dinosaur ghosts, right? There are ravens, there are, you know, traditional sheep ghosts, which have eight eyes. Why do they have eight eyes? I don't know. It just looked kind of interesting. I don't know if that's terribly disappointing to hear. I'm thinking again of like my youth when I would like fall in love with a song or something, and then I would hear the artist explain the song, and it was not at all what I thought it was about, and it would be like it'd be so disappointing to hear like, oh, I thought I was into that. I thought I was picking up what they were laying down or whatever. So I guess I'm going to think about this and just try to be careful when I'm doing book tour stuff and find ways to answer this that validate what somebody else is bringing to it. Because that's the final thing I'll bring to this, is that when it comes to hoping people get whatever out of the book, I think I said this recently, there's something about art when it goes out into the world, when the book is published, it's no longer totally mine, right? There's going to be what the reader brings to it from their own perspective and experience, and how they engage with it is not, I don't get to take full credit for it, right? So let's suppose for a second that it becomes super phenomenally popular. I'm going all over the place on this one, and I don't, but I feel like these ideas are all connected at least. Let's say it becomes like a bestseller and thousands, let's say hundreds of thousands of people read it. And I walk into rooms and everybody's very happy to see me because they really enjoyed this thing that I made. I like to think that I will still have the presence of mind to understand that this isn't entirely my doing. This is something about the ideas that I put into this book meeting the world in such a way and at just the right time. Because every one of these people are going to have their own experiences when they meet this thing. This is what I'm explaining when I'm talking about, like, when I fell in love with a song and then find out that the artist didn't intend that at all. And going through that sort of like the mental gymnastics of like, did I interpret the song wrong? Did I like the song in the wrong way? No, it's how I like the song, and that's fine. The important thing is that I like it. What I bring to it is part of why I like it. So I'm trying to use this to contextualize whether or not I'm worried about what people are going to get out of it. The main thing is I just hope they find something entertaining and meaningful in it, whatever that happens to be. I've had this happen a number of times in the various books that I've made where characters that I think are going to be received this way are received that way. A big one was when I was working on The Front Rebirth as a ongoing webcomic back in like 2003, I created this character named Galen, who was like, that's the old motif of like, he's like the master of any kind of weapon. He can pick up a weapon and just do something with it. And he can turn any object into a weapon too. He's the lethal assassin, got long, beautiful gray hair, and he's like speaks very formally. And he's got this kind of like David Bowie, kind of like half closed eye, like self-assurance, borderline disdain for everybody around him. And I thought, this is going to be the character that all the dudes who love Boba Fett are going to love this guy. And I just got a lot of feedback from women about this character. They really, and it's the thing where it was my own myopia. I just wasn't thinking about the entire audience, right? But those kinds of surprises happen where it's like, well, you think it's going to happen this way, but it goes that way. So I've kind of let go of that. I've kind of stepped back and said, like, you know, that's not up to me. All I can do is make this thing so that it delights me. And I just hope that the people I made it for enjoy it in whatever way they do. This one sent me all over the place, but I'm grateful for the prompt. So if you enjoyed the way I think about this, I hope you will check out baronvonbear.com. It's this book that I made that means a lot to me. There are prompts, there's action items to do on the page, like signing up for the email list or other things. Be alerted when it's available. Thanks to everybody who has been supporting this project. It means a lot to me that you believe in it. Because as I'm recording these things well before the book comes out, and I'm releasing them just before the book comes out. So the fact there's people listening to this now, when I'm recording it, who believe in it before they've even read it, that's amazing to me. That is very affirming. Helps me believe in the project a little bit more. And if you have any more thoughts, questions, wonderings about it, you can submit them at baronvonbear.com/AMA, even after the book comes out, because I'll get a text alert that says, hey, there's been a new prompt, and I can continue to add to this series of essays responding to what you're curious about, what you're wondering about in terms of this particular book or just making comics in general. But, you know, if if I had my preference, I would say, like, yeah, if it could be about the book or these kinds of books, that'd be helpful to me. So I'll be back soon with another Thunder Punch Daily. And until then, remember, everybody.
Today we saw Professor Smolin find a great treasure. It wasn't gold or jewels, but something even more precious, knowledge. There are many places to find knowledge, and one of the easiest and best is a museum. Museums are storehouses of knowledge where you can see and learn all sorts of fascinating things. There's probably one close to you, so pay a visit. Remember, knowledge is power. And you can get the power.